It's not this disease that you developed or inherited. It's your attempt, a doomed one, to solve the problem of pain. So my mantra is, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain.
Welcome to The Promise of Music, the first World Congress on the Social Impact of Music. And friends, we're pleased to be starting today in conversation with Dr. Gábor Maté, family doctor, author, internationally renowned speaker, whose best-selling books include In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, Scattered Minds, The Origin and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder, When the Body Says No, The Costs of Hidden Stress, and Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers, and most recently, with his son Daniel, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Gábor, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be with you.
So I'd like to arrange our conversation in two parts. First, laying down some basics on your work and insights on trauma. And second, of course, getting to the subject matter of our Congress, music. First of all, to begin at the very, very beginning, can you give us a working definition or your understanding of trauma and put it in the context of your own work and life?
Yeah. What's interesting is how many times I've had musicians, pop musicians, and classical musicians and opera singers come up to me and says, your work has meant so much to me, you know? So it seems to be the case that there's a lot of trauma energy in the music world, which is an interesting question as to why that might be the case. But trauma, broadly defined or simply defined, is literally from the Greek word, it means a wound. So it's a wound that hasn't healed. If you were wounded but it healed, you're not traumatized. So trauma is a wound that hasn't healed, which means that trauma is not the events that happened to you whenever they happened, but they impact within yourself. So trauma is a psychic wound in that sense that hasn't healed yet. So it's what we're carrying today, and it's any wound that hasn't healed will have certain symptoms, manifestations. So trauma has multiple manifestations in human functioning, and one's relationship to oneself, to others, to society, to the world in general. It's a wound that hasn't healed, and most of the time it's sustained in childhood.
And in your own practice and in your research and experience, from my reading and listening to you talking, one of the things that's very startling to many people is how pervasive trauma is, and also how long it can stay within our psyches, and also that sometimes its manifestations can be delayed in coming to the surface. You've undoubtedly seen a huge number of different ways in which trauma makes itself known and felt. Can you give a little bit of that range?
Yeah. First of all, Peter Levine, who's one of the great trauma psychologists, he says that it's trauma is simply the most common and the most ignored cause of human suffering. And as a physician, I saw its manifestation in multiple ways, in the medical world, in physical illness. Like, for example, Canadian study that showed that men who were sexually abused have double or triple the rate of heart disease, regardless of whether they smoke or drink or not. Mm. A study out of Harvard a few years ago, showed that women with severe post-traumatic stress disorder have doubled the risk of ovarian cancer. Multiple studies have shown a relationship of trauma to multiple sclerosis, to rheumatoid arthritis, to malignancy, one could go on. And the same thing is true in the mental health field, that depression, anxiety, psychosis, any number of mental manifestations are very often rooted in trauma. So it can manifest in illnesses of all kinds. It can also manifest in addictions, so that according to all kinds of research and also my own personal clinical observation, but again, to not to restrict it to what I've seen, but also what the research shows, addiction is largely rooted in trauma. So are personal problems, like in a relationship, a marriage relationship, or any kind of personal interaction. Trauma very often shows up, influences people's perceptions of the present based on their past wounds. So there's no area, and then if I want to mention politics, oh boy, you know? So trauma manifests in all kinds of ways, and it can show up any time in life. A person might be functioning okay, seemingly, but then they decompensate. Or a marriage breaks up, and all of a sudden, they're in deep crisis. And so it can show up anytime, and it can show up in multiple ways, and there's hardly any way that it cannot show up.
It the way you've described it, this is a crude analogy, but it almost seems comparable to the herpes zoster virus. You know, you get chickenpox as a child, and then, you know, 30, 40 years later, you get shingles, and it's basically been inside you the whole time.
That's a good analogy. Although, to any careful observer, the signs were there all along. Mm-hmm. People just haven't noticed them. And specifically, I mean, you have migraine headaches, huge relationship between childhood trauma and migraines. But you can go to a doctor for years, all you get is pills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nobody will actually say, well, what's this thing that's lurking inside you that the headaches are manifesting, you know? So, it can be a long time before it shows. But again, it depends on who's looking.
Right. And what must make it especially challenging is, first of all, of course, the person suffering, first of all, may not even recognize if it's a behavioral manifestation that this is anything other than their normal self. And they also may not, they likely will never be able to trace it back to its root cause in early childhood. And in some cases, they may not even remember the event or incident that created the trauma, or at least that they responded to traumatically to begin with.
The fundamental assumption of a lot of people is that there's something wrong with them. So rather than asking what happened to me, they say, what's wrong with me? In fact, a book written by a trauma psychiatrist, Bruce Perry, along with Oprah, is called What Happened to You? As opposed to, you know, what's wrong with you? That's the first thing. The second thing is, when you say about not remembering, depends what you mean by memory. Because this is, again, that's scientifically, this is not controversial, but there's all kinds of memory. So there's recall memory, there's recall. That's called explicit memory. When you recall, you can call back. You can recall what you did last night. You can recall what happened in a certain day at grade five in school. That's recall memory. But there's implicit memory, which is the emotional imprints of early experiences from in utero onwards, actually, that are imprinted in your nervous system, and they don't associate with recall, because recall only comes along at a certain point in life. Number one, like 3-4 years of age, very few people have recall before then, because the part of the brain that calls back doesn't even exist, or isn't it online until then, number one. Number two, in times of great stress, the recall centers in the brain can be suppressed. So it's not unusual for people to recover memories much later on. But having said that, the implicit memory, which is the emotional reaction to things without recollection for the original event, that's very common.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to spend too much time with somebody to tell you what their memories actually are. once I see how they react to certain situations, those reactions are very often based on emotional imprints for which there may or may not be recall. That's one. That's another point. The third point is, it's rarely just one incident. It's rarely just one incident. It's more like an overall situation that goes on for a long time that we're talking about. Like even in cases of, say, sexual abuse, it's, you might say that's the incident, but there's a whole background to it. And the background is usually a child who's got no one to go to for protection. And like lack of protection is chronic. The abuse is a discrete incident or a set of discrete incidents, maybe over a short time or a long time. But the lack of protection, that's chronic.
Right, right. And it also seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the situations, or whether it's individual incidents or something that is chronic as you describe, can be highly subjective. In other words, what might seem from the perspective of adulthood to be a relatively minor incident, when seen from the perspective of a child, can have an extremely scarring effect. And others, for example, yourself, the thing that started this chain in motion, or this train in motion, can be something extremely dramatic and of sort of monumental consequence, like surviving the Holocaust.
Let's take a very simple example. Nothing to do with the Holocaust.
Right.
But from my life. And I describe this in The Myth of Normal. Yeah, I spent my first year under the Nazi occupation of Hungary and came close to losing my life. All kinds. I don't have to go into the details here. But let's take an incident that happened before the Nazis occupied Hungary. When I'm 2 weeks of age, still in the maternity hospital with my mother, and she kept a diary. And she writes, "My poor little son, my heart is breaking for you, because you've been crying since 11:30 at night, and now it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning, and you've been wanting to be fed, but I promised the doctor that I'll only feed you on schedule every 4 hours, and it's not time yet." Okay, so here's an infant crying for an hour and a half, and a mother whose heart is crying out to feed him, but she is under the authority of the physician and is ignoring her own heart and my own desperate cries. So forget the Nazis. What message do I get at age 2 weeks?
You're abandoned. You're abandoned.
They're abandoned, that I don't matter, my feelings don't matter, you know, I don't get, this world is not supportive, I'm all alone. And this from a person who just loves me, totally, you know. So, you say it's trivial, so what, a baby cries for an hour and a half, there's no so what.
Right.
That message, if it's chronic, boy, is it wounding. And actually, you can't recall it. I don't recall crying as this who we called, but I'm sure that sense of having to fight for existence and being alone and being isolated and not being held, it shows up in my marriage 5 decades later. And so there's no trivial, there's no minor when it comes to child wounding.
And in talking about how trauma can manifest in what we think of as physical disease, it is clear that that mind-body connection is extremely powerful and operative in instances of trauma. And I'm assuming, at least from my reading, and I'm certainly no expert, that a lot of that has to do with the release of certain hormones, certain chemicals in response to events of stress. But are there other factors that can, you know, lead to, for example, inflammatory conditions or cancers and so on? Do we have an understanding of what the mechanisms are?
First of all, just adjustment of language. You talked about the mind-body connection. There's no mind-body connection. It's a unity.
Right.
It's not two separate things are connected to each other. it's that it's a unit.
Right.
I mean, physiologically, scientifically, it's a unit. So the psychic apparatus, you know, the emotional circuits in the brain are part and parcel of the same system, of which the immune system, the hormonal apparatus, and the nervous system is also a part of. It's all one thing. Now, so trauma and the stresses that it imposes later on in life can show up in the release of stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol, and it does. It shows up also in one's propensity to get into situations which will be stressful, where there'll be increased release of stress hormones. But in the long term, the same stress hormones that in the short term save your life by giving you more energy and more sugar and more strength and more vigor to resist or escape from a threat, those same stress hormones thin your bones, narrow your blood vessels, increase your blood pressure, turn on genes that can cause cancer, turn off genes that can protect you from cancer, debilitate the immune system, put fat on your belly in a way that increases the risk for heart disease, can cause depression. People who are severely traumatized in childhood, you can measure certain inflammatory particles, proteins in their blood, they'll be elevated, which means they'll be more prone for autoimmune disease and malignancy. I mean, it just shows up in a multiple. It affects with the development of certain brain circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the manifestations of the physiological manifestations of trauma are almost infinite.
And another thing that you have written and spoken about, and I think it's increasingly understood, is the intergenerational aspect of trauma, that the effect once traumatized of one person may then be lead to behaviors that result in trauma to their children, and so it can be passed down. And it almost calls to my mind the way our myths or folk songs or nursery rhymes can literally be traced back centuries, passed by word of mouth, but in this case by implanting a kind of psychic toxicity into the minds of the next generation. And you almost have to wonder, what impact has this had on human history when you start to think about this happening in the realm of the powerful and the makers of history?
Well, you mentioned nursery rhymes. Take one like Rock-a-Bye Baby. Think of that one. Rock-a-Bye Baby, in the treetop, when the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the wind blows, the something. And then The cradle will fall. Dawn will come.
Cradle baby at all.
Baby at all. Oh my God, falling out of a tree?
Yes.
Well, what is that all about? It's about not being held. Being absolutely insecure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you, to go to the historical part of it, trauma is always multi-generational. In my case, I passed on my trauma to my kids. Not because I didn't love them, not because I didn't do my best. That was my best, limited by what I understood about myself and how I was still activated and motivated by unresolved traumas. So my rages, my dissatisfactions, my addictive behaviors, these all impacted my family long before I was aware that I was behaving under the effect of traumatic experiences and traumatic dynamics. In terms of history, I once looked at some of the great mass killers in history. So who were they? Take Alexander the Great. You know, the Great. Great for what?
Mm-hmm.
He was a mass murderer.
Right.
Now, I know that he spread civilization, and there's a certain role of, you know, the Greek wisdom and civilization spreading. You know, and I understand the historical ramifications, but basically, he invaded all these countries and killed all these people. For what? For power. You know, if you look at Napoleon, if you look at Hitler or Stalin, what's interesting about them is, I know the Greeks don't like me saying this because the Greeks love to claim Alexander the Great as their own.
Right.
But actually, he wasn't mainstream Greek. He was a Macedonian.
Macedonian, yes.
And the under, the, you know, the Greeks, the actual Greeks proper, loathed the Macedonians and they feared them. And there were all these speeches by Demosthenes warning against the Macedonian threat. So he was an outsider.
Right.
Napoleon wasn't French. He was Corsican.
Yep.
He spoke French with a very pronounced Corsican accent. Stalin wasn't Russian. He was a Georgian. Hitler wasn't German. He was an Austrian. So these guys are all outsiders. Number one, they all tended to be rather short people. And if you look at the childhoods of them, they were very traumatizing childhoods. Now, having said that, if I look at the childhoods of many modern political leaders today, severely traumatized people. I mean, Donald Trump, as my friend and colleague Bessel van der Kolk, who's the world's leading trauma psychiatrist, he says that Trump is a poster boy for trauma. And he is. If you read the biography of that family by his psychologist's niece.
Yes, Mary. Yes.
And Trump's grandiosity and his aggressiveness and his selfishness and his insatiable ego. Insatiable because it can never be satiated. His aggression. These are all trauma manifestations. And then these people get into positions of leadership. And then they impose their view of the world on the world. And it's a sign of our disconnection from ourselves that many people can look at these people and see them as strong protective figures that'll keep us safe. You know, it's like people are infantilized and they look to these political leaders as the parent that'll look after them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take care of it, don't worry, you know.
Well, right.
And then we get what we get.
And then we get what we get, and it's incredibly destructive. One of the things that strikes me as among the greatest tragedies, and I know you can speak to this from your own practice in Vancouver's downtown East Side, is the way we, as a collective, as a society, treat those who have suffered the greatest ill effects of trauma, those who are suffer from addictions to various substances and who lose their homes and live on the street and are then shunned and treated as essentially the refuse of society. That's, I mean, a characterization, not how I feel, certainly.
They are the ones who have been refused by society. That's totally true.
Right. So we actually decide that those who have been wounded, those who have been hurt the most severely, that we can only respond to them by wounding them again, over and over and over again, looking the other way.
Unless you elect them to political power, which is a different story.
Well, a different, and usually a different kind of addiction, or at least control to the point where they, you know, don't end up, you know, wandering aimlessly on the street. But you know what I mean, literally.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
You can be addicted to power or to profit. And then in that addiction to power and profit, you will deny reality. And you'll destroy the world. And you'll be seen as a great leader. And you'll be successful and you'll be rewarded and validated and enriched. Or you can be addicted to heroin, in which case you're hurting nobody but yourself. Except because it's illegal, you'll steal to support your habit, you know, as opposed to stealing politically in the form of tax rebates and tax exemptions.
Right.
You'll be stealing underwear. And then you'll be ostracized.
Right.
Now, if I define addiction, as I do, as manifested in any behavior in which a person finds temporary relief and pleasure, and therefore craves, but then suffers negative consequences as a result of, and doesn't give up despite the negative consequences, then in any given room that I give that definition, if I ask people, any behavior, pleasure, relief, craving, harm, not desisting, any behavior, could be drugs, alcohol, nicotine, could also be shopping, eating, gambling, self-cutting, work, bulimia, internet, extreme sports, any behavior, sex, of course, pornography.
Workaholism.
Workaholism, absolutely, yeah. And I say, well, according to that definition, how many of you would agree that you had an addictive patterns at some time or another? As with this audience that we're addressing today or any other audience I ever speak to, if I say, well, how many would acknowledge that? Most people, including myself, will put their hands up. And then my next question is, well, not what's wrong with the addiction, but what's right about it? What do you get from it? People say, I get relief of stress, numbing, relief of pain, freedom from negative thoughts, sense of connection, sense of vitality, sense of control. Well, who doesn't want those things?
Right.
In other words, the addiction wasn't the primary problem. It's not this disease that you developed or inherited. It's your attempt, a doomed one, to solve the problem of pain. So my mantra is, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. Now, if you look at those people that you mentioned, the refused ones, the ones that, you know, Dostoevsky may call the insulted and the injured, you know, the ostracized, who are they? They're people who are severely traumatized in childhood, sexual, you know, in all my years in the downtown east side, 12 years, I didn't have a single female patient who had not been sexually abused as a child. Trauma, unbelievable trauma. And their solution is to numb themselves with those drugs. And then we ostracize them and we punish them for having been hurt, even though we glorify other addictions that are actually destroying the earth. And so that, why do we do that? Because we get to project parts we don't like about ourselves onto these others, and then we get not to deal with them ourselves.
Right. Thomas Hobbes, who I think of as one of the great philosophical villains of human history, I think in one of his books said, we enjoy the pain of others because it is not our own.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
He also said that life is
nasty.
Short, nasty, and brutish.
Yes.
And I always think he should have said short, nasty, and British because he... Because he was describing British life at the time of rising capitalism and fraying feudalism.
Right.
Life was short, nasty, and British, you know.
Yes.
But he projected that experience onto the world, onto life itself, which
as
was,
as in fact the empire did over many subsequent generations. But it's very interesting that you talk about that and raise capitalism or at least any system of social organization that could be, if I can use the term, traumagenic, productive of trauma, that we also have in human history, and you've certainly established connections to this, other models of organizing social being that are not based on that. And if I can sort of put this in a Western philosophical context, it is, you could say it is sort of the clash between the Hobbesian view of the world and that of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who, you know, it's usually improperly characterized as his myth of the noble savage, but basically the starting point is assuming that the world is plentiful, abundant, and nurturing. That's the Rousseau image of the world. And Hobbes, who basically has what we would later call a Darwinian view, which is we're in a perpetual state of shortage, and that throws, you know, warring factions into conflict to try to take what the others have so that they can survive. And then what you have is a war of all against all, and then, you know, go forward, a couple of hundred years, and you've got the so-called dog-eat-dog world, which Margaret Thatcher characterized by saying, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals and their families striving for the best for themselves. So not to throw so much of sort of that history of ideas into collision, but your work with Indigenous Canadian people and in the Americas strikes me as offering an alternative. Very difficult to see how it can be infused into the kind of deeply entrenched society we have now, but that it is not fundamental to humanity to live in social systems of organization that are traumagenic. Would you agree with that?
Well, Rousseau, who famously writes in the beginning of his Social Contract that man is born free, but everywhere he's in chains, and he's wondering why. He was very much influenced by reports of French and other explorers and missionaries in North America, and their reports about the indigenous people. And the reports were often that these people are proud, they're independent, they're free, they're not intimidated, they're not suppressing themselves. And this very much influenced a lot of the thinking of the Enlightenment, actually. And if you look at human evolution, what we call civilization, and as soon as you get civilization, you get traumatization.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just talking about modern capitalism or the modern empires or the Roman Empire even. We're talking about the very beginning of civilization. But prior to that, we all lived in small band hunter-gatherer groups out in nature. In fact, there have been humanoids or hominins living in the earth for millions of years. Our own species, Homo sapiens, has been here. We made our entrance on this stage, I think, about 200,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago. And whether you look at the millions of pre-sapiens existence, or whether you look at just Homo sapiens itself, let's just look at that. If you can picture our own species existence on the earth on the face of a clock until 5 minutes ago, we lived out in nature in small band hunter-gatherer groups, where the communality rather than individuality was the only way to survive. And if you look at indigenous societies, this has been studied all over the place. Wealth was measured not by what you acquired in terms of objects, but in terms of your personal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And by how much you gave to others, actually. It's a totally different assumption about human life and what abundance means. And if you take the ceremony of the potlatch here in the west coast of Canada, which is where chiefs would invite relatives and friends and give away all this wealth, a ceremony that was suppressed by the British colonialists because it goes against the capitalist ethics.
Right.
We don't want this kind of stuff happening. So that if you look at all the studies, and there have been multiple studies of indigenous societies in nature, they have a totally different point of view. And now, it's not a question of romanticizing anything. There was slavery here on the West Coast, you know, for example. But on the whole, there was a connection with nature. There was a sense of abundance, of nature being giving, of gratitude towards the gifts of existence. That was the basic ethic. And there's a film coming out, actually, the week that we're recording this. It's called The Eternal Song. And it's really about the indigenous culture's attitude towards life and humanity and parenting and the world and the universe. It's a totally different set of assumptions about the world that they made than what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Once civilization comes along, private property, power divisions, class distinctions, the patriarchy suppressing the female, you get all kinds of trauma. And, you know, that's only been adapted and exacerbated by modern capitalism, but it didn't invent it.
Right. And, well, the Eternal Song sounds like a good place to segue to our discussion of music. But before we do, I just wanted to add one extra thought, which is that we do seem to be trapped in a kind of a winner-take-all or zero-sum game mindset, which I associate in part with an imperial mindset, which is to say, I am not rich unless you're poor. I am not strong unless you're weak. I am not powerful unless you are powerless. And the concept of, you know, what I think 19th century socialists or anarchists called mutual aid, where our strength is in the support we give to each other, is very hard to recover, even though we're all so surrounded by people who actually do want to help others, who derive joy from the good that they can do and bring to the lives of others, especially those in greater need than themselves. So I think that we can probably agree with Rousseau that that is a human instinct, that it is somewhat imprinted on us by nature, and that it is at least a source of hope that there can be a way found for it to derive greater force in our public life.
When you look at the physiology of the brain, and this has been studied, we seem to share certain emotional brain circuits with other mammals,
mm-hmm.
which include anger, which is necessary for self-protection.
Right.
grief, which is necessary to come to terms with loss. Fear, obviously, is necessary. Seeking, curiosity, playfulness, and caring.
Mm-hmm.
It's embedded in our brains. It's embedded in the brain of any mammal, actually, because the young doesn't survive without it. And human beings especially need that care, mutual care throughout our lives. If we were rugged individuals by nature, we wouldn't exist. So that caring is very central to our nature. Now, it has to be evoked by the environment. And if the environment is not appropriate, those caring instincts will be shut down. And aggression and greed will take their place. But there's no circuitry in the brain for greed.
Right.
Greed is a secondary response to lack of care. We have to grasp things because we're not going to get it otherwise.
Yep, absolutely. And that leads to competitiveness. Well, there may be a kind of a natural tendency towards competitiveness, but the kind of competitiveness which is the beggar thy neighbor type. And with that, just to sort of finish off this, I'll throw in a little aphorism that comes from our organization's namesake, Glenn Gould, who was very much opposed to music and arts competitions and competition writ large. And he once said, in the final analysis, it is not money, but competition that is at the root of all evil.
Well, competition in the sense that somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. There's actually competitiveness. We're wired for play.
Right.
Now, we're in play, there's competitiveness.
Right.
But the whole point about play is it doesn't matter who wins or loses.
Right.
It has no consequences.
Yep.
It doesn't matter if I run faster than you do. There's no consequence.
Right.
You know, so that nobody loses anything, really. It's just for the fun of it. So in that sense, you know, wrestling, you know, kids wrestle, you know, competitiveness, there's nothing wrong with it as long as it's playful. Once competitiveness leaves the realm of play, then it starts presenting its dangers.
Right. That isn't competition in which someone goes hungry, loses their home, yeah, or dies.
Or loses their self-esteem.
Right.
Or the sense of self-worth.
Absolutely. Okay, let's turn to music.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.